This is
KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the third weekend of October 2020. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. A group in Austin trying to educate people about their rights when facing eviction.
There's this, the added worry of people having to leave their homes during a pandemic.
UT Austin trying to limit the spread of COVID-19 while struggling to ban parties.
I'm scared because what I'm seeing is what I'm seeing, but what I'm not seeing is what scares me most.
And a vegetarian restaurant that's been open for 40 years, going out of business because of the pandemic.
Mothers switched to takeout only. We immediately had a 75% drop in business.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend.
Today's the first day of early voting.
This was Tuesday.
October 23rd is going to be the last day to ask for a ballot by mail. If you're going to wait that late, then what? I am so sorry.
Let me fix this.
This is Travis County Clerk Dana DeBevoit dealing with government meetings in the Zoom era. Got some technical problems there, but she's responsible for running elections in Travis County, among other things. She was talking to the commissioner's court. Let's hear what she had to say.
Okay. I'm going to try my best to continue.
Okay.
I do not suggest that people wait till October 23rd to ask for a ballot. You're pretty much guaranteed that you will not make it through the postal system. If you have to ask for one that late, plan to use hand delivery. And then, of course, November 3rd is election day with 178 vote sites. All of our poll workers will be wearing masks. Their judges and their delegates are going to be wearing masks. And we require every voter to wear a mask. If we have a voter who shows up without a mask and refuses to put one on, that would be most unfortunate for everybody around this person. They will still get to keep their right to vote, but we are going to put them as far away from everybody else as we possibly can. And we hope we don't have too many people who are not willing to do their part to stop the spread. We also clean the equipment frequently during the day, but actually voters don't have to touch anything when they come in to vote. They'll have a little plastic finger covering to sign the e-poll book, and then they'll have a popsicle stick to mark their choices on the ballot marking device. We have coordinated several security responses and security plans with our local law enforcement. That's both the sheriff and APD. And we're now in the process of making sure we have those same arrangements in all around Travis County at the various in the various cities. We know that there's a lot of threat out there on social media, especially about marauding bands of maskless militia that are going to be trying to take over the polling places. Come on. You don't have to hire, spend $1 million and hire a bunch of PhDs to hack an election. All you have to do is go on social media and say you did it. So I'm pretty sure that this is the same threat we heard before, and it never came to fruition. I don't think it will this time either. But our election judges in the polling place understand their rights and responsibilities to keep proper decorum in the polling place at all times.
So that was Tuesday. And what happened next was huge turnout. Almost 36,000 people cast ballots on the first day. And that was about 2,200 more than the presidential election in 2016. And remember, this is an extended period of early voting, so people do have more time to vote during the pandemic. But KUT's Claire McInerney was out there on day one speaking to some of the first people in line to vote during this election.
Tiffany and Jeremy Cohen were very upbeat at 6:45, but they'd had a while to wake up. They were the first people to get to the Ruiz branch of the library to vote, which Tiffany thought was a little over the top, but her husband wanted to get there early.
No, we were just, I didn't think that being here at 5:30 meant anything, but now that we have a line behind us, I'm glad we're able to.
Many polling places had long lines, but a lot of people were willing to stick it out. Antonio Schaefer, a Del Valle resident, was right behind Tiffany and Jeremy. This is only the second election he's voted in, and he said he's feeling the weight of voting this year.
Well, concerned about everything. So, I voted once in my life, and that was the Clinton, Hillary Clinton. So, and it didn't go well. So, you know, I'm going to try this time again. And so
early voting goes until October 30th. Claire McInerney, KUT News.
We have a lawsuit going on right now over how many mail-in ballot drop-off sites each county can have, because Governor Greg Abbott issued an order saying it could only be one per county. This was right as the sites were about to start operating, where people can drop off their mail-in ballots instead of putting them in the mail because they feel more secure handing them to an official than just putting it in a mailbox, especially considering the recent controversies around USPS. So first, a federal appellate court sided with Governor Abbott. This week, a state judge in Travis County struck down the order, saying counties could have more than one site. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton disagreed with that district court's order and filed notice of appeal, and Paxton said that put the order on hold for now. So this is a whole bunch of legal back and forth, but basically the situation now is counties can only have one site where you can drop off mail-in ballots. In Travis County, it's 5501 Airport Boulevard, and even with the single site in Travis County, a lot of ballots have been coming in. Here's KUT's Ashley Lopez.
As of Thursday morning, Travis County Clerk Dana Debevoise says 33,000 mail-in ballots had been returned to her office. She says that's more than she would expect for an entire presidential election. Debevoise says about 86% of the applications for mail-in ballots have been from people over 65. And she says she thinks the pandemic and worries about the post office are driving a lot of voter behavior.
We knew it was going to be a big turnout. We knew that the by-mail was going to be quite the tsunami, and we've hired extra people to be able to handle it. So we're pretty confident that we're keeping up.
Debevoise said she is also planning to get more equipment that counts mail ballots to speed things up so they can release the count of all mail ballots that are in-house at exactly 7 p.m. on Election Day. Ashley Lopez, KUT News.
It has been very difficult to keep track of all of the different national, state, and local bans on evictions for renters. One order expires, another order is put in place, another order is modified. So one nonprofit in Austin is trying to educate renters about their rights by going door to door. KUT's Audrey McClinchy reports.
Jerima Arana is standing outside an apartment complex in Pflugerville, just north of Austin. It's early, around 8 a.m. on a Sunday. Arana doesn't live in this building, but hundreds of people do, and at least two dozen have faced eviction so far during this pandemic.
So what we're doing is hanging door hangers, obviously respecting social distancing, with information about tenants' rights and eviction protections.
It's a simple idea. Hang a plastic placard, a door hanger, on the doors of tenants living in complexes where landlords have filed evictions during the COVID-19 pandemic. The door hanger directs renters to a website where they can learn about current eviction bans. Arana is with the nonprofit Building and Strengthening Tenant Action, or BASTA.
Evictions has always been an issue, but right now during the pandemic, obviously, there's this the added worry of people having to leave their homes during a pandemic, basically having to expose themselves to this virus, and it could be an issue of life and death.
Arana carries a black backpack with hundreds of door hangers. She starts climbing stairs and hurrying down hallways, popping each placard onto a door handle. Christina Rosales is the deputy director of Texas Housers. The organization's been watching eviction hearings throughout the state, and what they've seen is that
renters continue to be confused about the protections that apply to them.
You can't blame them. Eviction bans during the pandemic have been dizzying. First, there were local bans, then a statewide one, then a national one, but it only protected some renters. Then that expired, the state one too. Then in September, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued a new order, once again protecting most renters in the country from eviction if they couldn't afford rent. But, says Rosales,
this is different. The moratorium is different.
That's because with the CDC order, a renter needs to sign a piece of paper and give it to their landlord to qualify. The paper, called a declaration, states you've lost wages or work hours and you've tried your best to pay part of your rent during the pandemic. But at least early on, some renters didn't seem aware of this new requirement. I watched three eviction hearings in Hays County days after the CDC order came down. The judge would ask, "Have you signed the declaration?" Each tenant said no. Leslie Ramirez works for the Austin Tenants Council. She says while some renters seem to be up to date on current eviction bans now, they still get calls.
They'll call and say, I know I have rights, I just don't know exactly what they are. Can you kind of walk me through what my options are? Because this is what my landlord is telling me. I just want to make sure if that's right or, you know, not.
Ramirez says she's gotten more confused calls from Spanish speakers and worries there's not enough information about eviction bans in languages other than English. That's in part where Arana comes in. She hands out hundreds of door hangers. The goal is 10,000 over a series of weekends. The information's in English on one side, Spanish on the other. The hope is that this will help tenants know their rights at least through the end of the year. That's when the CDC eviction bans set to expire. Audrey McGlinchey, KUT News.
So on Wednesday, every county that borders Travis County allowed bars to reopen at 50% capacity under an order by Governor Greg Abbott that let county judges make that call. Travis County Judge Sam Bisco says he could not in good conscience allow bars in the county to reopen at 50% capacity. Bisco says he made that decision in consultation with the interim health authority, Mark Escott. And Escott has pointed to an increase over the past 10 days in COVID-19 hospitalizations, patients in the ICU, patients on ventilators. So Bisco says he's not going to let them reopen for now, but he will reconsider it in 2 weeks. Like I say, all the surrounding counties around Travis allowed bars to reopen on Wednesday at 50% capacity. KUT's Allison Ortegon reports from Williamson County.
Judge Bill Gravel plans to monitor the reopening, but noted that many bars in the area have already opened by serving food, and he wants this decision to open the remainder.
We have figured out how to open schools. We have discovered how to open businesses. We've discovered how to open governmental offices, and now it's time to open all businesses in Williamson County.
Bars that are in the Austin city limits but are also in Williamson County will also begin operating again. The Bastrop and Burnett County judges have also allowed bars to reopen today. Alice Ortegon, KUT News.
Austin Bergstrom International Airport has been especially hit hard during the pandemic. Passenger traffic is way down. That means revenue is way down at the airport. And officials at ABIA say they've maxed out the direct relief they can offer concessions companies to help keep workers on the job. KUT's Samuel King reports.
The cancellation of ACL and Formula One means the airport won't see its typical fall boost in traffic. The airport has waived rent and other fees for companies that operate at the airport this year, but officials say the financial impact of that is unsustainable, so they're looking at other ways to help. Executive Director Jacqueline Yaft says the past 6 months have been challenging.
We're starting to have conversations with the airlines because we have a certain forecast for FY21 of what the recovery looks like, and we want to make sure we are working with them. It will take us a few years to recover back to the pre-COVID number.
While passenger traffic is currently down around 70%, the number of badged employees at the airport is only down 21%. Officials say that's a potential sign that many employees who are furloughed would be able to return to work quickly if a recovery happens soon. Samuel King, KUT News.
Housing market in the Austin metro area of the five-county area, it's doing things it has never done before. The number of homes available to buy is at one of the lowest rates it's ever been, 1.3 months of inventory. And prices are shooting through the roof. People want to buy homes. Not nearly as many people want to sell homes. The Real Estate Center at Texas A&M University put out a new report on all this week. So I called up their housing economist, Jim Gaines, and asked him what he's seeing.
Well, in Austin, it's been extremely strong, as measured by the increase in sales activity, as measured by the increase in prices that are going on, and the general interest level. For example, in September, home sales were up 31% versus September a year ago. Home prices are up. The average was up 15%. The median was up 12%. Now, a more realistic measure of home prices is a price per square foot. And we watched the median price per square foot, but that was up 8%. So you're seeing extremely strong demand. And at the same time, though, the active listings, the number of properties being offered for sale is almost 50% less than what it was a year ago, which means that it's an extremely tight market. So if you've just sold your house, you're in good shape. If you're just now buying one, congratulations that you found a house for sale.
I mean, we obviously have low supply of homes for sale in Austin.
Right.
How much construction is going on to help fill that demand?
Well, relatively speaking, construction has been pretty strong. Austin has been leading the state in terms of the rate of increase in home construction. The big problem, the home builders are doing the best they can to build homes, trying to build homes in the quote unquote, the sweet spot of the price ranges in the Austin market from $150,000 to $350,000. If they can get a new home built somewhere in that price bracket, they have no trouble selling it. The issue is that the home builders, quite frankly, can't build houses fast enough to keep the market balanced in terms of the supply and demand. So very strong housing, home construction market.
Well, what is slowing them down from being able to build more homes?
Limitations on the construction market. Labor has been one here, particularly the last 6-7 months. General contractors and the subcontractors hiring the labor specialists, the brick masons, the carpenters, roofing materials, et cetera, they have trouble getting labor just like anybody else because of the virus. They still have to have spacing on the work site. They have to have masks. They can't have positive COVID tests, of course. So there's been a real problem in finding labor. The other is, of course, land and lot inventory. Now, the big home builders, the major home builders, don't have much trouble because for the last several years, for the last 10 years, they've been in the land development business as much as the home construction because they've got to create the lots to build the houses on in the first place. But the small and medium home builders that rely on third-party land development and so forth have been fairly restricted. And then we've heard also from home builders that they've had trouble with materials, both in terms of cost. For example, lumber prices are up almost 150% from a year ago for various reasons, not the least of which is that we get about 30% of our lumber from Canada. And there's a tariff on it. But also materials, for example, LED lights and light fixtures and other fixtures that come from China. And obviously imports of materials and goods from China have been dropping off. So it's not that they're not available, but the delivery is slower and takes longer and costs have gone up for that fact.
I assume that's going to push prices higher.
There's a
number that leaped out to me here, and it's not something we typically hear about outside the real estate business, which is single family private construction values up in Austin by more than 30% to a record high. Can you explain, first of all, what are single family private construction values and why are they so high?
In a nutshell, that's the cumulative dollars spent on single family construction. So if you built 100 houses for $1 million a piece, it'd be $100 million. I mean, it's just the total construction value. And so what that's telling you is there's a lot of homes being built. They're costing a fair amount of number of dollars per. And I can tell you the cost per square foot in Austin has jumped up dramatically in the last 2 years, particularly and especially the last year. And for the reasons that I was just enumerating of why costs are getting higher. And of course, we look at that because it's that total dollars spent on construction that impacts mostly the entire economy because those dollars get spun into the local economy.
Jim Gaines, economist at the Texas A&M Real Estate Center. Thank you so much, Jim.
You're more than welcome. You're more than welcome.
The The University of Texas at Austin has faced a crucial problem in containing the spread of coronavirus on the 40 acres. Most of the classes are remote or a combination of in-person and online, but thousands of students have returned to school, and most of them are living off campus. The university has banned gatherings on and off campus, but college students are still doing what college students do. They're having parties. As KUT's Andrew Weber reports, UT says it's learned lessons from earlier on in the pandemic that it hopes will slow the spread of COVID-19.
Let's start with spring break 2020. Yeah, I know. It feels like 14 years ago, but back in mid-March, UT found itself at the epicenter of a national news story.
Approximately 70 people in their 20s traveled to Mexico more than a week ago for spring break. Again, this was on a chartered flight. 28 of those people on that trip have now returned and tested positive for COVID-19. Dozens more are now under public health investigation by Austin Public Health.
Nearly 200 students went to Mexico on spring break. When they came back, a lot of them had COVID. All told, 64 people tested positive. The incident sparked outrage, and the university had to act quickly. It isolated them, tested them, and began the grueling work of contact tracing. It was a real-time experiment, like building a plane while you're still in the air. The isolation was critical, but Darlene Bafnani, an epidemiologist at Del Med, says there was another key factor, one that was kind of a double-edged sword.
The one lesson that we learned from March is that a large proportion of these cases are younger and healthy.
So they're not at high risk for complications for COVID-19. That's good, obviously. Now, for that other edge of the sword, these folks were mostly asymptomatic.
You know, we are seeing that. But what that means is that students might be infected, walking around, socializing, mixing, studying, working, and unknowingly infecting others.
All of this is a little obvious to us now, but keep in mind this was before the Austin area went under lockdown, before the state's shutdown order, before there were even 100 cases in Travis County. Still, nobody from the trip died, and UT's handling of it was lauded by a lot of epidemiologists. So when UT planned for the fall semester, it baked in some restrictions for students to avoid another Cabo. Classes would be mostly online, parties would be banned on and off campus, but UT officials insisted they would lean on the city of Austin to enforce that ban. The university also forged ahead with the Longhorn football season, which, unsurprisingly, meant parties. And ahead of the Longhorns' first home game, there was one specific party in the West Campus neighborhood just across from the 40 acres.
There's not supposed to be any parties happening in West Campus, which, you know, I understand that's something that's not easy to enforce.
That's a West Campus neighbor we're calling Rob. He wasn't comfortable using his name. He's been in the West Campus area for a couple of years. His wife graduated this spring, and they were set to close on a house in May. But his wife lost her job, which meant they had to stay at their place, which is next to a frat house, for a little longer.
Around 5 p.m., I go outside and I see that there's just, it must have been hundreds of students going in and out of the party in the frat house.
So he called the city to complain, asked they send someone out there, and they said,
the city has several complaints both for Friday and Saturday about the party and that they would start an investigation on it. Within the next 3 days, to which I was like, well, that's great, but they're not going to be partying in 3 days. They're partying right now.
The city told him to call UTPD. UTPD forwarded him to UT's behavioral COVID hotline. He spoke with someone there. They said they would open an investigation and that he could take it up with the dean of students on Monday. All of this just left Rob frustrated.
So there's been no accountability on these students. There also isn't accountability on the people who claimed they were going to take accountability out on them. So, you know, a few months ago before the UT reopened, they kept talking about the zero tolerance. There'll be no parties in West Campus. There'll be none of that. We're going to take care of it. And I called the city, UT, and UTPD, and nothing happened.
Rob's frustration isn't happening in a vacuum. The departments tasked with enforcing these bans on parties and gatherings largely aren't enforcing them. That's the case for a lot of college towns across the country. In Austin, only 4 tickets for gatherings have been issued since March. To be fair, one of those 4 tickets was for that party, the one Rob complained about. But cities and counties continue to struggle with enforcing these orders. West Campus presents a particular problem. It's the most dense neighborhood in Austin, and the West Campus zip code accounted for 40% of the complaints about gatherings in the entire city from August till late last month. But Darlene Bafnani says while there's been a cluster at a couple apartment buildings, there hasn't been an explosion. Still, that could change quickly, or it could flatten off.
I mean, I'm scared because what I'm seeing is what I'm seeing, but what I'm not seeing is what scares me most, right? And so you're just seeing the tip of the iceberg.
Bhavnani says the key to more of that iceberg is testing, contact tracing, and isolating folks who are COVID positive, the same things that worked after spring break. But there are some obstacles to achieving those goals. The university told faculty and staff federal law won't allow the school to require testing for students unless it's before football games or other ancillary events that aren't education-related. Contact tracers are overworked. Bhavnani says they're putting in 12-hour shifts 7 days a week. They're getting help from Austin Public Health, but they're relying heavily on volunteers. And, most importantly, testing is voluntary. And if students test positive, isolation is too. Modeling from UT shows if student-to-student transmission at parties and gatherings gets higher, it could contribute to a spillover in all of Austin. But that's a worst-case scenario. Again, for now, Bhavnani says those chains of transmission aren't getting longer.
So far, transmission chains, the majority of transmission chains seem to be short. But it's only a matter of time. If we keep seeing, you know, behavior that's going underground or cases not being detected, it's quite possible that those chains will lengthen. And so we are watching very closely.
Bhavnani hopes more students get tested. It's anonymous, she says, as is contact tracing. And she says that is the university's best hope to shortening and eventually breaking those chains. Andrew Weber, KUT News.
The website Eater Austin is keeping a running list of restaurants closing permanently during the pandemic. Some of these restaurants are closing one or two locations, keeping another open, like Veracruz All Natural. Others are closing forever, like Threadgill's and Fricano's Deli and Blue Dahlia Bistro. Mother's Cafe is about to join that list. It's a vegetarian restaurant. It has one location that opened 40 years ago on Duval Street in Austin's Hyde Park neighborhood. This was the number one song on the radio back then. That's 1980. Now it's 2020. So I spoke to one of the three co-founders of Mother's Cafe, John Silberberg.
Mother's, like all restaurants, experienced the changes this spring, and we switched to takeout only. We immediately had a 75% drop in business. As we learned and read more about airborne and aerosol transmission, like many restaurants, we concluded that opening the dining room for dine-in was fundamentally not safe and a risk I didn't want to take and also didn't want to put our staff in that situation. And also, we just didn't get that many inquiries about dine-in, and I thought the Mother's Cafe customers probably, like me, sensibly cautious and ready to put some aspects of life on hold so we can get past this more effectively. And so we were never going to be able to recover enough revenue to do more than limp along, paying only a portion of rent. Unlike some restaurants, we had a lease that was ending in September. We had an option to renew, but there was just way too much uncertainty to renew a lease under these conditions. So we were able to look at it and say, you know, we do have a way where we can just make this be over and allow our landlords to pursue other options. And they've been great, basically. They've like, whatever you guys are doing is fine. Whatever your route is, they we're going to be, thanks to PPP, going to be able to make them whole on the 6 months of the lease that remained after this all began. Thank you, U.S. taxpayers, on behalf of the landlord and keeping us out of a fight over where that money's coming from. I have staff here now who are working at other restaurants also as their primary job, and those restaurants are doing dine-in. And each of these people independently use the word terrified to describe how it feels going to work every day at their dine-in restaurant. We're not going to put anyone in that position. We're not going to do that. And your listeners, the KUT audience probably knows this, but it never hurts to remind people that people working in restaurants are worried. They're concerned about what possibly will happen. And the honest truth is, as we know, there are people going out and acting as though this thing isn't real, and they're going to be disproportionately represented in the dining in restaurants public. So they're talking about people who will wander through a restaurant without their mask on, who are not assiduous about following safest practices. It's just not something that's possible.
When y'all opened Mother's in 1980, what were the vegetarian restaurant options in Austin like at that time?
There had been a variety of options in the 70s facility. So there was a lot of these sort of latter stage hippie era health food store endeavors going on. Most of those had dwindled by 1980 when Mother's opened on Duval Street. Mother's is sort of like the restaurant that came along and kept that going. Saferway Natural Food Store closed as John Mikey teamed up with some of the other people operating small independent health food stores and opened up, you know, the legend to be Whole Foods Market. So that went away. Some of the others went away. And Mother's was the one that then continued and persisted.
What kept you going for 40 years? That's a long time for a restaurant to operate continuously.
Well, I tell everybody the real story behind the longevity of Mother's Cafe is built on low personal income expectations and owners having no other marketable skills or talents where we could pursue other endeavors. We're stuck. I don't know how to do anything else. And also, you know, just sort of a commitment to what we had all individually just sort of fallen into. We just wanted to do it, and we wanted to keep it going. And eventually, the decision that, why are we doing this? Well, it's because of what we devoted our lives to, and the idea of, you know, let's do something else. I'm gonna take a class and learn other skills and get a tech job just never seemed to be a good idea.
What are you going to do now?
Worry. Actually, we have our Cashew Tamari retail product. I think there's a lot of interest in that.
The salad dressing.
The salad dressing. We have gotten a lot of encouragement from people who know it and tell us that there's a real future for us. We have teamed up with what's called a co-packer, somebody who will take on the production and also guide us in broadening our market impact. So we're hopeful that we can broaden, get more stores, get more shelf space.
Right. And do you imagine reopening ever in any capacity as a, whether it be only dine out or only take out or anything like that? Because obviously right now you have this big dining space you're paying for that's not being used.
Right. We're functioning as a food truck with great big storage space with lots of furniture in it. But we have sort of nosed around the idea of a food truck. If we could find the right location, which we might be able to, if we could find the right people, a food truck is something that we might be able to put together. A full service dine-in restaurant, that's 2 years from now before it could be considered. I mean, I've told you my age, you know, not many people 69 or 70 years old are thinking, I want to open a restaurant and work 7 days a week for 10 hours a day for a couple of months to make that happen and hope that it works out. If you're open for 40 years, you can extrapolate the age of the people owning the restaurant and what's age-appropriate endeavors for it. But a food truck is possible.
John, thank you so much for your time. Best of luck for all of your future endeavors.
Thank you, Nathan.
That's KUT Weekend for the third weekend of October 2020. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org and email any questions or comments to weekend@kut.org. Or just ask me on Twitter. I'm @KUTNathan. Our theme music is by RAC. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org.
Thank you.